Hey everybody, I'm Robert.
And I'm Chris.
And we are the Film Flamers. And we're here to talk more Nicole Kidman, as this is like an impromptu Nicole Kidman month.
Yeah, it's turned out that way.
I know.
We are just scraping the bottom of the barrel for themes.
And we don't even need them, but we do need Nicole Kidman.
That's true.
And we're here to talk about The Others. The Others is a 2001 gothic supernatural psychological horror film written, directed, and scored by Alejandro Amenábar. The film stars Nicole Kidman, obviously. Fionnuala Flanagan. Is that how you say that?
There's an O in there.
Fionnuala Flanagan.
Fionnuala?
James Bentley and Alakina Mann. The plot focuses on a woman mourning the loss of her husband in World War II in an old English manor with her two children while strange events begin to occur around them.
The Others was a worldwide hit, with word-of-mouth reviews and a strategically planned release that all contributed to its success. It was a definite hit in Spain, becoming one of the highest-grossing films for that country and being the first non-Spanish film to ever win the Spanish Best Picture Award.
Okay, listeners. I am your daughter. This is The Turning of the Shrew. I mean, The Others.
Sometimes the world of the dead gets mixed up with the world of the living.
As you can see, the housework has been rather neglected since the servants disappeared almost a week ago.
Do you mean they just vanished?
Into thin air.
How do you do, children? I'm your new nanny.
Are you going to leave us too?
Why should I leave you?
The others said they wouldn't, but they did, and then it happened.
Was Victor.
You told your brother that there was someone else in the room.
There was.
That'll do, Anne.
I've seen them too.
Have?
Sooner or later, she'll see them. Then everything will be different.
In 1945, Grace Stewart, played by Nicole Kidman, awakens one day from a nightmare. She lives in a remote country house in Jersey, a Channel Island formerly occupied by the Nazis. She lives with her two young children, Anne, played by Alakina Mann, and Nicholas, played by James Bentley, who have an unspecified disease characterized by extreme photosensitivity. While they're not vampires, Anne's sarcastic quips can be quite biting.
Never read this.
Grace hires three new servants. Housekeeper Mrs. Bertha Mills, played by Fionnuala Flanagan.
It's hard.
Fionnuala Flanagan.
There you go.
Gardener Edmund Tuttle, and a mute girl named Lydia. Mrs. Mills explains to Grace that she worked in the same house many years before. When odd events occur around the house, Grace begins to fear there are unknown others present. Anne claims to have seen a group of people in the house several times, a man, a woman, an old woman, and a child named Victor, who claimed that the house was theirs. After Grace hears footsteps and unknown voices, she orders the house to be searched, as she worries Nazis might be lurking behind any given corner. In the search, she finds a 19th century photo album of mourning portraits, photographs of the posed bodies of loved ones, presumably commissioned by previous owners of the home from a distant past. When Grace asks Mrs. Mills about her previous experience in the house, Mrs. Mills recounts that many left the area due to an outbreak of tuberculosis, and slowly the house became more and more empty over the years. Later, at night, Grace witnesses a piano playing itself and becomes convinced that the house is haunted. She runs outside in search of the local priest to bless the house. Before leaving, Grace instructs Mr. Tuttle to check a small nearby cemetery to see if a family has been buried there with a little boy named Victor. Tuttle finds the cemetery but covers the gravestones with leaves at the order of Mrs. Mills, who assures him that Grace will learn of the reasons behind the unexplained events in due time. On the increasingly foggy road into town, Grace runs into her husband Charles, played by Christopher Eccleston, who, after all this time, she thought had been killed in the war. Charles greets his children after the long absence, but is distant and keeps to his bed. Later, Grace checks up on her daughter, Anne, whom she has left to play in a spare room. Instead, Grace finds an old woman on the floor in the room wearing her daughter's communion dress, complete with creepy veil. The old woman claims in Anne's voice, "I am your daughter." Frightened, Grace attacks the old woman, only to find the old woman is merely an illusion, and Grace has inadvertently attacked her own daughter. Later, Anne tells her brother Nicholas that their mother has gone mad in the same way she did that day. But he doesn't recall. After speaking with her father Charles, he tells Grace that he must leave again for the front, even though Grace claims that the war is over. The next morning, Charles has left, and the children are screaming that the curtains are gone, thus letting in the deadly sunlight. Grace accuses the servants of having removed the curtains against her wishes and expels them from the house. That night, the children sneak outside and discover that the headstones in the cemetery belong to the recently banished servants. The children run away in fear when they turn to see that the servants are slowly approaching them in the foggy dark of night. Meanwhile, Grace finds a photograph that has slipped out of the Book of the Dead and fallen to the floor under some furniture. The photograph displays the posed corpses of the three servants who perished during a tuberculosis outbreak in 1891. The children run upstairs and hide in the bedroom, where they're discovered by one of the others, the elderly woman. Mrs. Mills and the other servants return to the house, and upon hearing the children scream in panic, Mrs. Mills tells Grace to go upstairs and talk to the others, now referring to them as intruders. Grace ascends the house to save her children, only to discover that the old woman is in fact a medium in a seance with a family, including the boy Victor, who has found out via automatic writing that Grace smothered her children to death with a pillow in a fit of despair before committing suicide. Grace realizes that the others are the family that has moved into the house, and that she, her children, and the servants are, in fact, all dead. In a fit of shock and disbelief, Grace violently attacks the seance, rocking the table and ripping up the papers used for automatic writing. Following this display of supernatural and spiritual activity, Victor and his family nope out of the house, leaving it to the possession of the ghosts. However, because they're dead, Anne and Nicholas' ghosts are finally allowed to play in the sun without harm. Mrs. Mills informs Grace that others will come to the house, and that they will need to learn to coexist together. But Grace ominously states that the house is theirs. As she says this, a for sale sign is seen mounted to the gate.
The twisty end.
What a twist. What a twist indeed, though.
Oh my God.
My goodness. I'm sure we'll be talking about that with presently.
Mm-hmm.
So The Others was released on August 10th, 2001 in the United States on over 1,600 screens. It grossed $14 million at the box office opening weekend, securing the number 4 spot behind American Pie 2, Rush Hour 2, and The Princess Diaries.
It stayed at the number 4 spot for 3 more weeks, all while adding more screens to its total. By its 4th week of release, it would claim the number 2 spot. Ultimately, it would earn $96.5 million in North America with a worldwide gross of $209 million against a budget of $17 million.
This movie made a shit ton of money.
Yes, it did.
Like, ridiculous amounts of money.
Paid for their divorces.
Yeah. Because he produced this film.
Yes, it did. Right now.
I really, we were talking off mic a little bit ago about the release strategy of this film. And I posited that maybe they were just going to release it smallly and just kind of make as much money as they could. But obviously, like we talked about in the intro, like word of mouth really spread for this. And it was like on multiple more screens as the weeks went by.
Yeah.
So, I mean, a good release strategy for real for this film.
Yeah. And I remember seeing this in the theater.
Me too. I did. The Others holds an 84% on Rotten Tomatoes and is certified fresh. The audience score sits at 77%. The consensus reads, The Others is a spooky thriller that reminds us that a movie doesn't need expensive special effects to be creepy.
Peter Travers for Rolling Stone praised the film's atmosphere, writing, Only some bumpy, arid passages in the script keep the others out of the masterclass occupied by The Sixth Sense and 1961's The Innocents. When it comes to turning the screws of psychological terror, Amenabar is an expert technician.
I would agree. I think he makes fantastic movies. A little less kind, Roger Ebert gave the film 2.5 stars out of 4, praising that Alejandro Amenabar has the patience to create a languorous, dreamy atmosphere, and Nicole Kidman succeeds in convincing us that she is a normal person in a disturbing situation, and not just a standard-issue horror movie hysteric. However, he noted that in drawing out his effects, Amenabar is a little too confident that style can substitute for substance.
Although the film deals primarily with the spiritual interaction of ghosts with each other rather than with living humans, William Skidusky of The Observer suggested that it was inspired by the 1898 novella The Turn of the Screw, written by Henry James, which I agree with.
I do too. I mean, obviously, like when you have a movie with two small children in some sort of like gothic type environment or atmosphere, like it's one of the first things I'm going to think of. And especially if the two kids, or at least one of the two kids, are the ones that's primarily seeing, you know, the quote unquote ghosts, that clearly, I mean, like, yeah. Henry James all over it.
Yeah, I called it in my Letterboxd review, and I think we used it above mm-hmm. a little bit, you know, the turning of the shrew. The turn of the shrew.
It does have a surprisingly large amount of accolades. I guess it's not surprisingly. It's a good movie. It has a lot of accolades. At the BAFTAs, it was nominated for Best Screenplay and Best Actress.
Well, mostly nominations, I guess, not accolades.
I know. Well, I mean, it's an accolade just to be nominated.
That's, yes. At the Golden Globes, which we don't talk about. At the Globes that shall not be named. It was nominated for Best Actress for Drama for Nicole Kidman.
The Tarnished Clothes. At the Goyas, which are the equivalent of the Spanish Oscars, it was nominated for Best Actress, Best New Actress, Alekhine Mann, Best New Actor, James Bentley, Best Original Score, Best Costume Design, Best Makeup and Hair, and Best Special Effects.
It won at the Goyas for Best Film, Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Production Design, Best Cinematography, Best Editing, Best Sound, and Best Producer.
So it was nominated for every fucking Goya, apparently.
Yeah, they were so proud of this.
I mean,
we're like, it's our national, it's our export. It's our best export this year.
Or ever, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. At the Golden Schmoes, our new favorites, it was nominated for Best Actress, Best Breakthrough Performance, Nicole Kidman, which I want to talk about in just a minute, Best Screenplay, Best Supporting Actress for Fenella Flanagan.
Breakthrough performance?
Yes.
Can we talk about this now?
It also won Best Horror Movie. Yes, let's talk about it right now. This movie was made in 2001, and Nicole Kidman had been in film for quite some time.
Remember, this is the Golden Schmoes, and this is based on their 20-year anniversary. Last year, this would have to be its first.
True. You're right. But still, Breakthrough? I should have looked up who the other nominees for this were.
I don't think breakout, right? I don't think, and it's not first appearance. Maybe what they mean is, like, this is her, like, most serious. But she did Moulin Rouge right before this, you know?
She was already famous yeah. by the time this movie came out. And
she was in Far and Away, and she had been in, I think, Batman.
She was fucking Batman.
Forever. Yeah. I mean, she was a big celebrity, and... you know, you could say mostly because of her relationship with Tom Cruise, and maybe this is where she kind of broke out of that a little bit more, but she'd already been doing that for like, you know, at least 5 to 10 years.
More than that. I mean, like Dead Calm came out in like 1989.
But what is interesting is that, you know, I go back and look at the trailer for this movie or the making of, mm-hmm. and it describes Nicole Kidman as Golden Globe nominee Nicole Kidman. This is before Oscars. This is before nominations. This is before she was up for any of that stuff that she later was.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't know if she was seen as like the serious, like Meryl Streep level actress that we kind of know her to be today.
Yeah, and that could be the case, you know? I mean, I guess in that particular sense, if we're going to call this, like, her first real big performance, right? Or first, like, serious performance, sure, call it a breakthrough, you know what I mean? But I feel like using that term, it needs to be, like, this is the first time that someone has, like, risen to a level of, like, public consciousness that she had already attained.
Yeah, and maybe that's it, you know? Although she had been in Eyes Wide Shut. Mm-hmm. You know, but I wonder if the public consciousness was closer to thinking about Nicole Kidman like they do, like Cameron Diaz versus Meryl Streep.
That's, you know, true.
She's definitely shifted over the years.
I mean, because today, like we talked about briefly in our Eyes Wide Shut episode, I mean, like, she's a respected actress today.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, she does lots of like limited series television and movies at the same time. And I feel like these days, whenever she's in a movie, there's always some sort of like Oscar buzz or Emmy buzz. If it's television, she wins lots of awards now. She's a gifted actress, yeah, for sure.
And I wonder if that sort of proclivity kind of cages you from doing more genre later on in your career. Yeah. Because I was watching the making of this, and she said she loves horror movies and that she wanted to do more of them. And especially after this success, she hasn't really been in much for horror since then, really.
Not really. I mean, you're right. I mean, like Killing of a Sacred Deer and like The Invasion, I think, is probably like the most notable.
She does return to the genre. She does. So maybe.
But not as often as someone who claims to be a horror fan.
She's definitely not, you know, I wouldn't call her a genre actress.
No.
She dabbles every few years.
I don't think that she's afraid to take a part that she likes.
Certainly more than Meryl fucking Streep.
Yeah. I mean, like Meryl said,
it's like Deer Hunter and that's it.
Yeah. Death Becomes Her, I guess.
Death Becomes Her. Oh, shit.
But no, you're right. Yeah. I mean, and when we talk about the cast of this movie, even if we just use that for reference, like we don't have to gush about Nicole Kidman anymore. But I will say, I mean, like, she's one of my favorite actresses, and she has been probably since like Batman Forever. I mean, I love Nicole Kidman. I think she's just fantastic.
I thought you were going to say Moulin Rouge, like Little Gay Boy should.
I mean, that's my favorite Nicole Kidman performance is Moulin Rouge. I mean, but I mean, I love her enough that I can rank her performances, and I can't say that about a lot of actors and actresses. Like I like her performances enough that it's hard for me to put them in a certain order. And the fact that there's a lot of them and a lot of them are good and you can rank things, I think speaks very highly of a person as an actor.
Yeah. I still think her best performance is in The Hours.
Yeah.
But possibly that prosthetic nose is doing a lot of heavy lifting.
I think so. I think that's her third best performance in my opinion.
Oh.
So.
Okay.
Yeah.
She got a lot of buzz for To Die For, which was earlier than this, I believe.
I really, really love her in To Die For. I think she's great.
Never seen it. Oh. But I think I'm about to because it's winning our poll.
Thank God. I really want to talk about that movie.
Okay.
What's this I see in the notes about an upcoming remake? I didn't know about this. What?
In April 2020, Sentient Entertainment had acquired the remake rights to the film. The company plans to revamp the film by setting it in the present day. Mistake. Later that year, it was announced that Universal Pictures will co-produce and distribute the film with Sentient. I think it's a bad idea to put it in present day. I really think the period of the film really serves the story a lot.
And
the setting, you know, so they'll have to do something equally as kind of removed from the rest of society to make this work.
I don't know why they're even doing this. Like, I don't, that's stupid to me. Yeah. This movie's good on its own. I'm going to revamp the film by setting that remake on fire.
Well, who knows? Maybe they're going to try and do something a little bit different, you know?
I guess. I mean,
like, maybe Flanagan will pick it up.
Maybe. I mean, they're going to have someone who knows what they're doing.
Definitely up his alley. He keeps telling Turn of the Screw over and over and over again. So.
Yeah, I know. He needs to get off that classic horror literature. Or don't, actually, because it turns out to be really good when he does it. So I don't even know what I'm saying. But yeah. There doesn't need to be a remake of this. Also, it's not old. This isn't an older movie.
Well.
Oh, shit. God. I'm constantly reminded that I'm 42 years old.
I mean, when you were watching movies from 1975 and 1995... Or 96, did you think of them as older movies? Yes, you certainly did.
Yeah, probably. I did.
Yeah. So that's equal today.
It's just
that we're older and we think it was yesterday.
Yeah.
But adults are drinking and driving legally that were born after this movie came out.
Oh my God.
Or about the same time. So
I love our conversations about period reference because it always makes me feel.
It makes me feel like I'm on my period.
Just decrepit. Well, we've already talked about Nicole Kidman at length.
Maybe we're like menopause.
Menopause. Do you want to? You want to talk about the rest of this cast a little bit?
Yeah, you were an adult 20 years ago when you saw this movie.
I was 21 in 2001.
Yeah.
Actually, by August of 2001, I was literally almost 22 years old.
Days away from going to college because I was 18.
Good times. What are we doing? I don't remember. Let me grab my dentures. Oh, we're talking about the cast. Okay.
Yeah, so this is a very good cast. Very small cast, but yes. You know, it actually has a few people in it, right? I mean, obviously it casts a few people in it, but more than you'd think, because it's very, very focused on these essentially like six people, and really only like three people, if you think about it, right? And that's Nicole Kidman and her two children, played by Alakina Mann and James Bentley. And then we've got the three servants, but we also have little cameos by the people that are possessing the house.
Right.
Or have literally possessed the house because they're real people. And we have like the father shows up for a quick minute, you know, and so it's a bigger cast than you'd think, but primarily it's that three people story, right? It's about a mother and her two children.
I would go so far as to say it's a four-person thing, because I think that Ms. Mills plays a pretty big role in this movie.
From an acting standpoint, you are absolutely correct. From a story standpoint, she is there to usher them into a new world.
That's true.
She is there as essentially a device to help them on their way, you know?
But, I mean, like, she forms attachments to the children early on. You know what I mean? She clearly fills a role more than that, too. I feel like out of the servants, clearly she's the most on screen, right? Because other one is outside all the time, and the other one's a mute.
No, she's doing with a look. She's doing so much heavy lifting storytelling.
Oh my God,
she's very, very important. So yeah, I agree. From an acting standpoint, the heavyweights are done by four people, and I would argue that Christopher Eccleston has a lot of things to do as far as just being there on screen and with his looks and what's going on, much less with his dialogue. You know, there's a lot of storytelling happening visually in this film, which I love.
Yeah, me too. And I mean, like, and just from a performance aspect, I feel like Nicole Kidman is excellent in this movie, like, first and foremost.
Yeah.
But even better than Nicole Kidman in this movie, I feel, is Fionnuala Flanagan. I feel like she is by far, like, the best actress or actor in this entire movie as Ms. Mills. She's just so good.
I thought they all four did just an amazing job of that core group. Mm-hmm. You know, just as an example, I think the direction here is very good, too. So I don't want to give the actors all the credit. I think this director knew exactly what story he was trying to tell with the tone. I mean, the guy edited, directed, and did the music for this movie. He knew exactly what he wanted. And he knew the nuance of everything that he wanted to do. Nicole Kidman, at one point, the first time she touches that shotgun, she opens to load it for the first time. She hesitates, like she remembers something for just a brief half of a second, and then moves on to what she was doing. You don't know what that is, or even might not even think about it your first watch. That is for the people that watch it a second time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's great.
This director makes really good movies, right? Yeah. I mean, have you seen Abre Los Ojos or Open Your Eyes, which was later remade into a movie in America called Vanilla Sky, right?
I've seen Vanilla Sky. And of course, that was Tom Cruise.
Right. But I mean, the original Spanish version is just an amazing fucking movie. I mean, this guy knows how to make like kind of oddball but engrossing films. You know what I mean? And so like it's perfect. And you're right. I mean, like, you can't give these actors the entire credit for what they do. I mean, because that brief second with her holding that shotgun that you described, that's direction, clearly.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like Nicole Kidman is gifted, but maybe not that gifted. You know what I mean? It's just too perfect of a moment to just leave it up to like acting happenstance. Like, clearly she was like fed that piece of information.
Well, horror movies is a lot of timing, especially in this type of movie where everything's hanging on tension.
Yes.
You know, and that instrument has to be very properly tuned, and it's very excellently tuned in this movie, specifically with the, you know, and especially with the scenes involving Nicole Kidman by herself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole piano scene with the door.
Yes.
You know, that's one of the best moments of the whole movie. You know, and those are moments that are expertly crafted by the filmmakers as well as the actors. And so it's just a really, really well-crafted movie where everyone kind of came to the table and was really passionate about what they were doing. You know, I do want to call out that Alakina Mann as Anne and James Bentley as Nicole Stewart, the children, sorry, Nicholas Stewart as the children were some of the best children actors I have ever seen in a movie. Easily.
I have to agree with you, for real, especially on Alakina Mann. I thought she was great in this movie. I mean, talk about like acting with a look, you know what I mean? Like she does a lot without saying things. And when she does say things, I mean, she's kind of acting like a child, you know what I mean? But like the look behind the eyes has a lot to say, right? There's like volumes of things that are being processed in her head. Like, I feel like she knows a hell of a lot more than most of the main characters, right? The family main characters that we talk about.
She's more open-minded and in a way less stubborn, but is kind of a fierce defender of herself while she still loves her mother. She has to do a lot of different complex emotions in this from moment to moment, you know, and she's doing an amazing job. And it's almost it almost invokes my memories of Claudia from Interview with the Vampire a little bit with that fierceness. She doesn't have to evoke, you know, I'm 200 years old or something, or I'm a 100-year-old woman stuck in a little girl's body or anything. But she gives me a lot of the complex emotions that Kirsten Dunst was giving in that performance, I think. And that by far for me is like my favorite child acting of pretty much any movie ever. Mm-hmm. And this is like a close number two for me.
Yeah, she is excellent in this movie, and very similar to the character of Claudia, and the fact that she's sort of trapped in something. You know what I mean? Like she's trapped in this darkness all the time,
and an antagonistic, you know, kind of relationship, you know, love hate relationship with their parent,
right? A quote unquote parent, you know, for different reasons. But yeah, I mean, like she's a very gifted actress, and like I was watching this with a friend, and she asked, she was like, oh my God, this girl's good. Like, what has she been doing now? You know? And so we pull up IMDb and the answer is nothing. You know, I mean, like she acted for a little bit after this, but she hasn't made any movies or TV like really since. Yeah. So, which is a shame. I would have liked to have seen like how she, you know, improved her craft throughout the years. Cause I feel there's a lot of promise in that young actress for sure. Mm.
So let's talk a little bit about the mise en scène.
Well, I mean, because this movie... mise en scène?
Yes, mise en scène.
This movie is nothing but fucking atmosphere. I mean, like, from start to finish.
Yeah, so. I feel like if Kubrick had been still alive, like, he would have just absolutely loved this movie as far as its use of, like, candle lighting and things like that. They're doing a lot of things. I was really trying to watch that this time because I remember last time wondering how they lit some of these scenes. And so I'm watching a lot of subtle kind of... oldest trick in the book kind of things where you're moving into another room and a key light kind of dims on from somewhere else, but it's made to look like it's just candlelight and things like that. So they were able to do a lot of tricks to really make this still kind of viewable, but also have amazing darkness and contrast in this movie because this house has to be completely shut down and everything outside is just fog. And all of that fog, I have to add, was completely CG.
Was it really?
All of it.
Ooh, I did not clock that at all.
Yeah.
I thought it would at least be like a fog machine or something like that.
No fog machine nary to be found on set.
Holy shit.
Right. So I thought they would have had something for them to walk through to show kind of wispies or something, but that never really interacts with them, right? It's something that they have to move through, and it's supposed to be kind of supernatural fog anyway. And so what they would do on set was for all the outdoor scenes, they would do the normal pass with the normal location. Mm-hmm. And then they would have the actors walking towards or away or standing somewhere, but they would have a big blue screen just on the set and they would just put it right behind them so that they could keyframe them out so they could show fog behind and in front and do the depth of field of the fog. I wouldn't have thought to use blue screen. I would have just thought I'm just going to put the fog element on top of everything and then like do some, you know, compositing. I'm getting a little into the weeds with special effects like that you could do in like After Effects. You could do this at home on your phone videos.
I mean, that's fine because I didn't know you could do things like that.
But they keyed them out to make the depth of field so they would come at, you know, they would be more or less visible depending on how deep in the fog they were. And you could also do that kind of with 2D effects as well, but they didn't. You know, I guess they did actually because all of the fog effects were filmed fog effects or things that they were able to put into the plate, but still kind of cut out the people to where it would mesh extra well. And you can kind of tell if you're looking for it that those people, the edges are a little bit blurred around them sometimes when they're looking outside through the window and you see the two servants talking to each other, you know, or the Tuttles with the gravestones or her coming up to the gate. Those were all filmed there on location, but with multiple passes, you know, just to create that that expert fog look. And it looks like it was there. It looks like it was expertly done, you know. It doesn't even look expertly done. It looks like it was naturally fogged.
Yeah.
I mean, looks completely real.
I'm kind of shocked right now. I mean, I didn't think that it was like naturally occurring. You know what I mean? Like it just so yeah. happens to be foggy when they were filming. I thought that it was created, but I thought it was sort of tangible fog.
Or even like they did it on this huge soundstage or something and they're using like backdrops or right. something. But no, they were actually like there a lot of the time. And
that's super interesting because one yeah. of my favorite scenes in this movie is when she is running through the fog and runs into her husband, right?
Yeah.
I think that there's lots of really tense moments in this movie. But that's like one of the most, you know what I mean?
So she's walking down, the camera's to her back, and she's uh-huh. walking down that big row of trees.
Right.
And someone's in front of her with a blue screen, just enough to cover her, and is walking behind you. So you're still seeing all the trees, and you're still in that environment. So that they have that plate, and then they have a plate with them just going through the trees without Nicole Kidman there with the blue screen. And they put those together with fog elements, and it works beautifully.
That's so neat. And now I have a much bigger appreciation for this movie, because I think that's like, again, expert direction. Like, this movie mm-hmm. is well-crafted, you know?
At the same time, like, I'm thinking about things that have come out recently, like Everything Everywhere All at Once. Mm-hmm. Those effects for that entire movie was done with, I think, six people.
Jesus.
Which is just crazy. They were just like, a studio house was way too expensive, a special effects house. So we reached out to all these, like, music video guys that we knew, you know, back in the day. And so they did basically everything versus even this team just to do the fog elements and maybe some elements during the seance mm-hmm. Was a team at least twice, if not three times that big.
I mean, because I do like the consensus on Rotten Tomatoes for this, right? Where it says that this movie reminds us that you do not have to have a bunch of special effects to create a scary movie, right? And there's not a lot. I mean, the piano playing by itself, the seance, right? And now that I know the fog was also a special effect.
Single thing that was done outside essentially was an effect. Had an effect added to it, mm-hmm. I'll say.
That's neat.
So it's more effects than you think, but they're all subtle, which really serves it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, because
it's not gimmicky.
It makes it more plot than anything else. You're right. It's not gimmicky because when she's running through that fog, through that, like, you know, arbor and runs into her husband, I mean, like, it feels incredibly claustrophobic in a sense that the house, it makes the house feel less claustrophobic. Does that make
sense?
It
feels like they're in a jar.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I've read horror stories where the jar is literally made of fog, essentially. You know?
Love it.
This is not a new concept, you know, but they did it very, very well. And I feel like it's fairly unique still. Mm-hmm. You know, you do have things like the mist, but that's a very physical object versus this is more metaphorical.
Right.
You know, and so it's really interesting because I love stories, especially in horror movies, and genre does this the most, where you have a setting that's basically another character. You know, like the fucking ship from Alien, you know, essentially they're on this fucking spiritual spaceship, right? Well, and they're blocked in by this fog. They can't leave. They don't know that, but that's the house, the surrounding land, the fog, it's all the same thing. And it's essentially another character in this movie.
Well, that's incredibly true of most movies that you would consider to be like ghost stories or haunted house stories, right? The setting has to be as important to the story as the characters are.
Yeah.
Because that's where like all the action, all the plot focuses around. I remember watching The Humans last year, right? Which a lot of people don't consider to be a horror movie. And I consider that to be a hugely successful haunted house story only because the setting that they created for that story in that movie, in that play, I guess, too, acts as a character. It's just as much a character as any people in that family. And I think The Others is similar to that, although it extends to everything around the house as well. Right.
Yeah.
So that's neat, though. I love that.
But I also just, I know we talked about it a little bit. I love how they're playing with darkness constantly. Mm-hmm. One of my favorites is showing the painting that's there. And it's like this famous like Renaissance painting or whatever. And it's just so subtly lit that it just looks so fucking menacing.
Yes,
it does. And then they light it. And it's just, I love stuff like that. I love the creepy stuff.
I mean, and that's like, again, expert direction. But I on this rewatch, and I've only seen this movie, it's probably like my third time to see this film. Like I don't watch it all the time. But I totally forgot about that painting moment. And then because I was scared. I was like, what the fuck is that? And then like a little bit more light comes on and I'm like, oh, it's just a fucking painting.
Okay. Yeah. I also look, it's almost it's not really, but I feel like it's a miracle of cinematography when you're able to have people shut all of the curtains in a room where it's so brightly lit. And then all of a sudden with seemingly no adjustments, you have just a candlelit environment because they've just shut down all the the light from coming in, and it just changes the mood of a scene so abruptly and so wonderfully, and you just cut that atmosphere with a knife.
Another one of my favorite scenes in this movie is when they're searching the house and she gets to that room where everything is covered in drapes, right? I mean...
Yeah, that was a little hokey for me. It's been hokey. Done more since then than before.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, think of Oculus and I think of It just off the top of my head have done that.
It's a big one. Yeah. But I mean, I on this particular rewatch, like she walked into that room and I was like, oh, I remember this. You know what I mean? Like I remember this part of the movie. And it's still effective though, because it still scared me.
Yeah, I didn't remember quite what happened in that room.
Right.
But I love that scene too, from a filmmaking standpoint, because she does uncover a mirror and then you think she sees something and it zooms into the mirror and she's out of focus.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the door close and she's like staring in horror, but she's out of focus. And then it whips back to her actual non-reflection, her real head. And it's completely in focus. And it's such a wonderful moment for filmmaking, in my opinion. I love reflection shots in general. And there's actually a couple of them in this. There's some that take place in a mirror and then it turns, you know, and you realize it was in a mirror all the time. And then, but this scene kind of, you know, rack focusing or whatever on the door closing with her looking through the mirror and then it going straight back to her face and being completely in focus is such good control of a camera that serves the storytelling so well. I was just like, wow, just while watching it. I love that scene.
I really wish that we had watched this movie together, actually, because I haven't seen it that many times, and I don't think I'm going to watch it a whole bunch after this either. It doesn't mean it's not good, you know what I mean? But I feel like a viewing of this one goes a very long way and can stay in your brain for a long time. Mm. But I kind of wish that we had watched this together, because I feel like we would have like talked about those scenes as they were happening, you know what I mean? There's lots of really good moments, really good effective moments.
Oh yeah,
in this movie.
The one that got Matt, I think, was when the piano was playing and she's like playing with the door because it keeps moving on its own.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, after a rewatch, that someone else is also essentially her counterpart in the real world that is also moving the door, you know, and I would have almost loved to see that counterplay, you know, almost like in a Patrick Swayze style ghost type of situation.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
To see that happening. But that would have given away everything too early.
I think it would have cheapened things.
You know, or maybe a shadowy figure, you know, that's the represents the real world. I don't know. That was still kind of kept it close to the chest. But still, it's a perfect moment. It doesn't need to be changed. I'm just thinking of ways. But that moment where the door finally slams right in her face and she falls back, that actually got Matt. And it's very rare to get Matt, and that got Matt.
I mean, I jumped several times in this movie. I think I have every time that I've watched it. So
yeah, he jumped. It was great. So, there's some themes in this, but honestly, I feel like this is one of those movies that's so expertly crafted, but it's also very simple in a way, right? It's simple and complex in other ways. But, you know, there's obviously themes of religion, motherhood, war. I'm not sure there's a statement or a so what on any of these themes. It's more of a piece of the end justifies the means of everything that's telling it.
Yeah.
And so that also affects my rating a little bit. And in order to talk about that, we have to talk about the twist. So do you want to go ahead and talk about the twist?
Yes, I think we need to. I mean, like, because I kind of didn't see this twist coming in this movie. I knew that something was off about the family, you know, like something wasn't adding up the first time I watched this movie.
That's exactly right. Because remember, in this time, like, twists are a little bit more... You know, they were actually kind of popularized by M. Night Shyamalan.
Yep.
Right. And The Sixth Sense had come out, and that's kind of it. And so this was kind of compounding. This was kind of like playing on that success,
mm-hmm.
you know, and maybe partially why it was greenlit so fast was because of that similarity. But this is a little bit more complex than that, in my opinion. To me, this is a better movie than Sixth Sense.
I would agree with you entirely.
Right. And so because Sixth Sense is kind of a one-off twist, right? But there's more going on here. It's kind of on a mystery story tripod, right? So we've got the family, we've got the servants, and we've got the others, right? It's more interwoven than Sixth Sense because you've got questions with all three. What's going on with this family? Especially when the dad enters the picture.
Yeah.
And then leaves it again so quickly. And then what's going on with the servants? Separately from them as completely separate entity, and then what's going on with the others? Because as soon as you start trying to figure out what's going on with the servants, you're like, well, it wouldn't make exact sense if they were ghosts if the others are ghosts, mm-hmm. you know? And so it's trying to kind of checkmate your guessing game before you get to it, because if you guess The Sixth Sense, you kind of got it, you know? But there's more at play here because they've put kind of three different groups of characters kind of against each other in an interesting way where it does kind of keep you going in a revolving way.
Yeah, because I mean, like the others in this movie, right? Are the others that we're supposed to believe are the ghosts?
Are the real people?
Are the real people. People? Like clearly, I mean, that's the twist. But they're not that menacing, really. Aside from like slamming doors and things like that, I feel like the most menacing part of this movie, from an audience standpoint, is the servants, right? Like they're the ones that really keep you guessing because they're the ones who are having like side conversations and clearly, yeah, know certainly more not than at
first. At first, you kind of trust them, and they're kind of a grounding thing for the audience, right? Because right now we're going, we have his mother's crazy, the kids, like, what's going on? This is a little too strict. The servants coming, and specifically Bertha, gives the audience someone else to kind of, you know, sit beside and watch the movie with and kind of experience the craziness of the mother and the situation like they are. And, you know, it's not when that is turned on the audience until Bertha says, we'll let them see the gravestones later, all in due time.
Right.
You know, that's kind of the first kind of fuck you to the audience.
Uh-huh. And I love it.
It's a friendly fuck you.
It keeps you guessing, like, for sure. I mean, like, when she's sitting there like, oh my God, you missed the top of the gravestone, put more leaves on top of it. And you're like, what the fuck are these people doing, you know?
Yeah.
And it's no longer a ghost story. It's something a little bit more...
Red herring.
Yes, you know? but it makes it tangibly scary because, you know, something physical could happen to these people aside from, like, a haunting. Like, they have actual invaders in their home, you know? And they start using the word intruders a lot.
Yeah.
And, I mean, like, this movie is kind of all over the place in the best way, because I mean it keeps you from guessing the ultimate twist, in my opinion. Like there's no way in the world that I saw that coming, the ultimate ending to this movie when I first saw it.
Well, I think for us back then that works, but we're not able to watch this movie the first time again since 2001.
No, we're not.
Right? So keep that in mind, because audiences today are much more used to those kinds of twists. Mm-hmm. It's much more saturated in the market, in TV and miniseries and movies. You know, because of the success of these films in the late 90s and early 2000s, you know, and so people are expecting it and they're trying to figure it out. They're trying to Nancy Drew it in a way that the audiences in 2001 or even the 90s or earlier would not have as much. They would have sat and kind of enjoyed the ride a little bit more, I think, versus now people want to feel like they're in charge. They want to feel like they're in control. And so they're trying to Nancy Drew it as they go through it. And that includes people like Matt that was watching it. He was basically guessing, trying to work it out actively and talk out loud over dialogue sometimes, just to kind of as one, maybe a self-comfort mechanism, you know, saying like, they're in limbo. I know they're in limbo. They've got to be in limbo. And I'm like, well, does that make sense with the servants? And then he would kind of second guess himself with the servants, and he would second guess himself with the ghosts, the others. Right. And so that's the third, that's the thing that this whole movie hangs on, is the red herring device. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it just would not work as much. And I don't think it would work as much for modern audiences. But I think that this movie has legs. And I feel like it should be more popular today than it is.
I completely agree.
Because this was fucking hard to find. Like, I had to, strangely, we both thought it was popular enough that we could go and just rent this movie on streaming or just watch it on streaming. But no, I had to special order a fucking Blu-ray.
Well, and that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not popular. It just means that it could be tied up in rights. You know what I mean? Now that we know that there's an impending, you know, remake coming out, I mean, that could be the reason why you can't find it anywhere.
They're probably trying to keep it close to the chest so that a new audience gets, you know, blown away by it. But it's not going to be anywhere near as effective, because anyone that's, you know, our age, and we're not old, you know, is going to be able to say, well, it's just going to be the fucking MW, you know?
I mean, I really was surprised by this movie, and I saw this movie opening weekend, and I was living in Austin, and I just had, based on the trailer, went to go see the movie. I was like, I love Nicole Kidman. I like horror movies. I like ghost stories. I'm going to go watch it. You know, I had no idea that there was this twisty ending, right? And I did. I mean, just like a lot of people who saw that movie early on, I like sung its praises, like, go see it. I'm not going to tell you anything.
Yep.
Go see it. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And it was just so fucking effective. And like one of the only times that I've truly, truly been surprised by a twist. I was just like, I did not see that coming. I thought 1,001 other things could have been a possibility, but not what actually happened. And that to me is completely impressive. I think the first moment that I really thought that what I was being presented wasn't true was when her husband shows up. I was just like, it was like the moment where I was like, okay, now something's not right. You know what I mean? Like, he clearly is dead and he is acting like a dead person. You know, I kind of thought maybe like Haunting of Hill House style, like ghosts are there or whatever all around. And he was just a ghost. But I never thought that the mom and the kids and the servants were ghosts. It was truly outstanding.
Yeah, I think I tried to work it out, and I knew that that was a possibility when I was trying to figure it out. But then I kind of gave up, you know, and I was like, I'm just going to enjoy it, but they better fucking explain it. You know, if they leave it like ambiguous, like this movie would have bombed if it was left ambiguous.
Oh my God,
you
know what I mean?
At the same time, they have to walk that line. If it's wrapped up too tightly in a bow or too pretty, then, and that's some of the issues I have with this movie is how it does kind of wrap up pretty quickly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it does. I mean, like once things are revealed, you know what I mean? You're right. It's just several minutes and it's the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I'm kind of okay with that. I like the ending of this movie. I like the idea of them like claiming their space as ghosts, you know what I mean? And trying to exorcise the living or whatever in a Beetlejuice kind of way. You know?
Yeah, and it's just more of the same from Nicole Kidman's character, which is I'm going to hold and toe the line.
Yeah.
You know, and this is the little land I have. This is what I'm given, and I'm going to protect it.
Back to that theme of motherhood.
Yep.
You know what I mean? I mean, like, she's not only just, you know, in control and protective of her family, she's protective of her land.
Yeah. So what if she smothered her children to death? I mean, she's still a mother.
She's still a mom. She cared enough about them.
No one's perfect.
To smother them.
So I have a theory.
Okay.
Yeah. And so just like last week with Eyes Wide Shut, you know, I have a kind of this kind of feels gothic, kind of a little Dickensian.
It's right? A little Dickensian.
And I have a theory that this is kind of a remake of A Christmas Carol.
Again?
No, actually. Not at all. But it's just funny because I believe that is the story that the little girl is reading that makes her believe that ghosts are always going around with sheets and chains. Mm-hmm. The only really reference to that is Dickens' A Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
And so I just thought that was funny that was kind of a reference in the movie when I just had the theory for that for Eyes Wide Shut. So I was going to be like, it's A Christmas Carol. Can't you see?
I was waiting. I always look at the notes and I stop myself before the fun facts, right? Just so I can like, let me know what you want to talk about sometimes. And then I saw that and I was just like, in no fucking way.
Yeah. I tried to put ACC so you wouldn't understand what I was trying to say, but you got it. So you just knocked the wind out of my reveal.
Sorry. It's okay. But Sheets and Chains. Yeah. That's total Dickens ghosts.
Yeah. Marley.
Oh.
So I got some fun facts.
All right. Lay them on me.
So obviously, we talked about this was executive produced by Tom Cruise along with, of course, the Weinsteins. So this marked the last collaboration between him and Nicole Kidman prior to their high-profile divorce, which was finalized actually the same week that the others released.
Wow.
Yeah. So apparently it didn't pay for it, but it probably helped them put some money back in the coffers after the expensive lawyers. I don't know.
No shit. I wonder how much I can't remember because I'm old and
she had to pay off the Scientologist assassins.
Jesus Christ. I've had a lot to drink since 2001. But I would imagine that when this movie came out, that was probably big news then, too.
I think it was more big news like in 99, 2000 when it was happening. But these things take a while. I mean, think of the Johnny Depp Amber Heard defamation case right now. This is like 6 years after that relationship ended.
I know. And I don't want to think about that. So it's not.
Anyway, so the children have an actual real disease known as xeroderma pigmentosum, which is essentially an extreme sensitivity to sunlight. So it's very rare with only about 1,000 people in the entire world that have it.
I am so glad this is one of your facts because when I was watching this movie this time around, I was just like, are they just making up diseases and shit? I was like, people aren't allergic to sunlight.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a real, you know, which makes it a little bit better for me because it is almost too hokey devicey just to make the house all dark and everything. And I don't know, but it is what it is. So next up, in a pivotal scene, Grace finds a photograph album containing pictures of people she believed to be sleeping. And Mrs. Mills informs her that they're all actually dead and that the people photographed the deceased in the previous 19th century. And in reality, people did photograph their deceased loved ones during the 19th century, and most were photographed lying down as if they were in a deep sleep, or others would be propped up in chairs, posed with favorite objects like children with their favorite playthings or adults with books and newspapers. And the reason many families did this was because that would be the only photograph they would have of their family members. And, you know, if they didn't take their photograph, they wouldn't have any kind of proof that this person existed, you know, visually. You know, as photography was a rarity in the 19th century. And so I feel like I knew this and I feel like you knew this.
Yeah.
But I feel like maybe some of our listeners didn't. But yeah, death photography is or was a real thing.
I mean, I've gone to exhibitions of these things. I mean, I think it's kind of morbid and creepy, but also,
yeah,
like also fascinating from a time standpoint, because you're right. I mean, like it was rare and expensive. And I mean, like you want to remember someone, and that's the way you can do it back then. I mean, it's creepy, yeah, but it's also beautiful to me.
I couldn't find anything on the ones that they showed that were real,
mm-hmm,
you know, but I'm assuming that they're not real. Because one of the photographs is of three brothers or three men kind of on a bench or mm-hmm something, and they're all dead. The guy on the far right is actually the director.
Oh, really? I have yeah no idea who he looks like.
They made him look fucking real, man. They made him look dead. Some of them might be real. I don't know. I doubt it, because these days, if you did that, there'd be like protests.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Probably. I don't know. But
I guess we'll have to find out with a fucking remake.
I don't know. Maybe it won't be in it. But maybe there needs to be a whole movie about it. There needs to be a whole movie about death photography.
Oh my God, you're right. That'd be an interesting movie.
Yeah.
Well, it might be a little too white noisy. I don't know what I have to say.
What's wrong with white noise?
Nothing. I like white noise, but I mean.
Excuse me, bitch. We can get Michael Keaton to be the photographer.
We have to write the movie, though.
Yeah.
Otherwise, someone's going to ruin it.
Ruin. We'll ruin it.
It's fine. We'll do the ruining. Thank
yes
you.
Yes.
That's what we'll call it. Mm-hmm. The ruining.
Yeah, I was like, what if one of those photographs you put down and then one of the eyes was open?
Ooh.
You know?
It's effective.
Just all of a sudden, you know, just, I love the subtle horror.
Mm-hmm.
The subtle things like, is it, isn't it, you know, type of thing.
Because there's
like,
a lot of that going on in this movie too.
Yeah. So anyway, so I have one last one, and it's a story about Alakina Man.
Okay. Right?
And so they had to shoot this like any movie, kind of basically out of order, but they had to really, really work hard to create consistency for Alakina Man, because she was addicted to craft services.
Well, she was getting a little fat, was she?
Yes. They had to change her costume sizes 3 times throughout the filming of the movie, as far as I know. And so they had to start like banning her from craft services, because they constantly had like cookies and muffins and like candy bar. Yeah, like constantly. And so she would go and she would snack up between.
I mean, but wouldn't you? I mean, now I would do that now as a grown up. I'd be like, I know I had to be consistent, but let me have another muffin.
Yeah. All I can say is I'm glad James Cameron didn't direct this. Otherwise, that girl would be dead. I remember what Tea Time did to him when he shot in England.
That's right. Oh, my God. He would slap that little porker. Well, those were fun. I really enjoy fun facts, and I'm super glad to know that their disease is real. So. Excellent. But we have some questions to ask.
That's a weird thing to say.
I know. I'm not glad that people have the disease. I'm glad to know that it's not made up, because that's kind of silly to me.
Yeah.
But we have some questions to ask about the others, like we do about every movie we deep dive into. And we're going to start with, is this a horror movie?
Through and through.
Yes, clearly.
Yeah.
This is a horror movie.
Let's move on.
I know. I mean, the fucking intro called it a thriller. And I'm like, it's not a thriller.
Fuck you.
It's a horror movie. Okay. Were you scared while watching the others?
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's jumps, there's creepiness, there's dread, there's everything that I love in it, and it's effective. Usually, I don't jump at jump scares, and creepy dread has to be actually creepy for me to, you know. And the fact that you don't know something, fear of unknown, is a huge device that they use a lot of different types of fear in this movie, and they're all effective, however fleeting, you know, and however spaced apart, but they're all effective.
I agree. I think this movie is frightening in moments. Yeah. Like, I remember seeing it for the first time in the theater, and I was just fucking terrified. And, you know, having watched a lot of movies from like the mid to late 90s and even early 2000s and what came after this, I mean, it seems like special effects were just everywhere in horror.
Yeah.
And this was a very simple, effective, creepy movie, right? And I just loved it.
I always want to say, like, this is the tail end of you know, this is the early 2000s, this is late 90s. Horror, especially compared to now, was kind of comparatively thin on the ground. We were getting things like The House on Haunted Hill, and then the remake, different version of that, like a year later or something, you know, Liam Neeson and like everyone.
Oh, The Haunting.
The Haunting, yeah. And The House on Haunted Hill. That was like all 1999 or 2000, you know, and I don't remember like Blair Witch, you know, but there wasn't like a steady stream like there is today.
Well, you're right. And that's, I think, because like the mid 90s, especially, we had like this growth of popularity with Scream for the most part, you know, that really caused a lot of horror movies to be made in a really quick amount of time. And then it got very stale. And it was movies like The Others that sort of came out of nowhere, because you're right. I mean, I was excited to see this movie because I feel like there weren't a lot of horror movies, you know, especially doing well at the box office. I mean, at the box office.
There you go again.
Box office. If you look at the other movies that were in the top then, I mean, it's like two sequels in The Princess Diaries. You know what I mean? And so like, I feel like that's what we got a lot of in like the early 2000s. And this movie sort of like snuck up and surprised everybody and reminded you that horror can be good and can be effective and can make money.
And can provide escapism.
Exactly.
Right? Because what happened literally like 15 days after this release?
9/11.
Yep.
And I mean, like, it wasn't until after 9/11 that this movie really crept up into the box office, you know? So, yeah, I mean, this is what horror does. This is what good horror does.
Yeah.
So, out of 5 stars, what would you rate The Others?
I gave it 4.
Okay.
And I'm tempted to give it higher just because it's so well made. It's so expertly crafted and everything else. But at the end, it almost gets too confident in itself. And, you know, if you're not invested in a film by the end, you know, then nothing's going to save it, you know. But I almost feel like it needed more interaction with the others or what have you throughout the film to justify walking in on a full blown seance where not only can you see one of the humans, but like all of them interacting with actual furniture being there and everything else, you know. And you could argue that's because of the seance that she's being able to see it, but it's so abrupt. And I guess that's the way it had to be, you know. And there's also some psychological kind of shortcuts that happen so quickly after that, you know. I do like that she mentioned to her daughter that, you know, she didn't know any better. She was no wiser than she was. Mm-hmm. But then she goes right back to that. This is our house, you know, and it almost seems a little truncated somehow. It seems like it tried to do too much with too little too fast. And it would have earned it with, I think, maybe 10 minutes longer of runtime or something. And so maybe this is an editing complaint or something else, but it's almost like too confident and proud of itself in that moment of twist. And it kind of hits me a little bit in the wrong way, but still an excellent movie, and I still rate it very highly.
The one, I gave it 4.5 stars, right? And the only thing that's keeping me from giving it 5 stars is the very, very end of the movie. It's not the seance. Like, I'm totally on board with the seance.
Sure.
I think it's great. I think it's super effective and also a scary moment and jaw-dropping because you're finally putting things together. You know what I mean? But you're right. The thing that I don't like about this movie is post-seance, when the family is leaving the house and they are confidently like, okay, this is our place or whatever. I also don't like that the children sort of have this realization about what their mother did. Like, they're fully aware of it.
Exactly.
But they go on about their fucking ghosty lives as though their mother didn't kill them. And I'm like, no, you guys have eternity to be pissed at her, but you're already like, okay, let's just build our house.
That's another thing. And I was just like, there needs to be a sit down here of, hey, this actually happened. It is almost like they're in this collective denial together in order to create a peace. You know, like they're gaslighting each other, you know, or something.
I mean,
which can happen in families, you know, but it seems like it's not serving the family or the story so much as it's serving the ending.
Exactly.
You know, and that's why I'm saying that the wrap up feels a little truncated psychologically for the characters. It feels a little cheap for compared to everything that we just went through that was so well done with timing and pacing and tension.
I mean,
you know, it's just like, okay, we're wrapping up.
Seeing the kids play in the sunlight, I think, is a good moment at the end. But then when they're like, you know, essentially embracing their mom and watching people leave the house, you know what I mean? I was just like, no, I don't really buy that. You know, I certainly don't buy it from Anne's perspective, right? Her daughter. I feel like that child can hold a grudge. And I feel like there should at least be a little distance between them. Maybe like have Nicole Kidman's character, Grace, right?
Or have one holding moment the son. Where the daughter is like, it will take time to forgive you.
I mean,
and then the mom says something like, well, we have eternity or something. You know what I mean? Something like that. Just fucking hang a lantern on
it. I mean, at the very, very least, if you're going to show them through the window when the family's leaving, have the mom embracing the son and have the daughter just stand a little separate. Just make it truer to that character enough. You don't even have to say anything, but that shot alone would be enough to say, like, we have some fucking issues that we have to work with.
Yeah, and that's the next step, obviously. Yeah.
And then we also have these servants still being servants. And I'm like, no, you're on the same kind of playing field.
That's another thing for me is that everything seems to be serving the twist versus the twist being incidental to the story we're moving through. Because we're also having, you know, fresh fucking dinner every night, you know, somehow. You know, the stores aren't going down, but like, how are they getting more food then if they're not noticing the stores of food going down? Like, what the fuck is happening? Because at this point, we're 2 weeks past their death. You know, is this just a fog that they're in? Literally, you know, like make it a little bit more apparent. But like, I know they're having to walk this fine line of not making it apparent to the audience.
Yes.
You know, so kind of side skirting that from the characters noticing, you know, but it would have been interesting for them to have a side comment like, servant, I need you to go into the town and get some food. You know, and then them say something, well, we're fully stocked already, ma'am, you know, or something like that, you know, something like Shining Hotel. You know?
I was going to say something very Torrance-like, right? I mean, so there's that. I mean, and I feel like we've talked about this at length already now, but the second point as to why I don't give this 5 stars is rewatchability. I feel like rewatchability plays a huge part in my rating system. If I'm willing to watch something over and over and over again, I rate it kind of higher. But the minute those servants stepped on screen at the beginning of this movie, I was just like, okay, I remember everything. You know what I mean? It's fun to try to piece it together while you're watching, but I'm not going to watch this movie hundreds of times. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because it will become less and less fun, and I will appreciate its direction and craft a lot less.
It's still fun to watch it after because there's a recontextualization.
Yeah.
You know, so you can watch this movie twice in two different complete ways, which is fun. And then you space it out by 10 years or so, and you're watching it kind of in between that experience. And it's fun to do that. And it's fun to introduce new people to it, for them to experience and talk about it afterwards. And so there's a lot of value in rewatch with this, and a lot of value in sharing it. And I think that's part of the reason why I had so much legs. It's because people were saying, you have to do this so we can talk about it.
The sharing in the moment. Yeah. I mean, I totally get that, but I saw this movie in the theater in 2001. I saw it when it came out on DVD, which was probably 2002, and I hadn't seen it since. So about 20 years it's been since I've seen this movie, and I recalled enough of it, you know, to wish that I had been watching it for the first time this time. Yeah. You know what I mean?
So, we can never watch it again for the first time. You know what I mean?
You can't. I know.
That's just one of those things. God, our conversation mentioning The Shining kind of reminded me of a scene where she's trying to give the mother medicine, her medicine.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Her fucking tablets or whatever.
Yeah, I almost wish she had been like, you know, they're sucking away your life. And here's your, this is medicine. You know, hand her a glass of whiskey or something. I don't fucking know.
Take your medicine, pop.
She was pretty, yeah. She was probably a little too Anglican for whiskey. Because damn, all those fucking levels of hell or whatever the fuck she was telling her kids about.
Jesus Christ. I know. That's also pretty scary in this. Like the whole conversations about like,
Christina,
Jesus Christ, Christina, bring the Bible. It's a different kind of mommy dearest. All right. So finally, and I don't know about this movie, but kind of important. Who's the hottest guy in The Others?
I guess it's Christopher Eccleston because he's basically the only man in this whole. Well, okay. There's Mr. Tuttle.
Mr. Tuttle.
But he's a little geriatric for my taste at this point in my life.
I do think that. How do you say his name? Eccleston?
Christopher Eccleston, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know. He's a Doctor Who.
We will say that. I think he's actually very attractive. You know what I mean? Like, I was watching this movie because, I mean, by the time that he showed up, I was just like, thank God he showed up, because what am I going to say for this question? You know what I mean? But he's actually an attractive guy and a really good actor. And I think he does a good job in this movie.
So. Another thing about his character is I thought I could have remembered from in the theater watching a moment like The Kids Told Me What You Did, but going more in depth in that conversation. How could have you? And I can't stay because you've done this, and more of that, you know, because there's something to mine there. Definitely. There's a whole conversation around that and why he left. And I think that's very fascinating to me. But I thought I remembered more there. Maybe it's just from my unpacking it later is what I remember.
I think that could be it, too, because I kind of remember that as well. I thought that they had an actual conversation. And when the camera cuts and it comes back and he's shocked and she's crying, you know what I mean? She clearly told him something after he had already heard it from his daughter. But yeah, I really like that scene. And I think like the sex scene is kind of good, too, in this movie. It's
tasteful or whatever.
No, but, it's just one of the many sex scenes where the camera pans to the fireplace and then it's morning. You know what I mean?
I mean, it's fine, but it's kind of British anyway. So,
where she's standing by the window, just kind of arranging matches.
Come on, baby, light my fire. I think that just about wraps up our conversation on The Others. As always, we want to know what you think about this movie and our conversation. You can do that on social media at The Film Flamers, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram.
You can email us at tiredqueens@filmflamers.com or call our hotline at 972-666-7733.
Cover my gravestone.
Oh, is the call coming inside the house?
I can never get past one.
Anyway, guys, that kind of wraps up our month of Nicole Kidman. Although, you can join us over on Patreon for what our patrons have voted for, which looks to be, at this moment, like To Die For. So if you want to hear our take on that film, go over there. And for future polling, join us over there on Patreon and vote away, as well as get early episodes for as low as $2.
But that's not all we have for you this month. There are 5 Mondays in May, so that means 4 episodes from The Film Flamers. And next week, we're bringing you the triumphant return of Hot Takes.
Oh my God, we are.
That's right. It's been a long while since we've had a Hot Take.
Some of those takes aren't so hot.
I know. Some of those takes have gone completely chilly, but still.
Some of them are burning hot because I have just finished a couple of things.
Oh, well, good. And I need to finish a couple more. So stay tuned for that, everyone. Well, Chris, I think it's time to go off and
jump in the fucking pool.
I know.
It's hot in here.
I was going to be like, closed doors one after the other. We have to open every door and every window because it's so hot. All right, let's go have some sweet. Oh my God, I can't say sweet first. What am I doing? Let's go have some sweet dreams. I am your pool floaty.